Well, you can tell you're in a Unitarian Universalist church when we say, we don't like this word in this hymn, so we're changing it. So sing something different. You gotta love it. Well, it's Labor Day, and Labor Day is certainly symbolic of many great things we have done in our country and in terms of the working class and working people. It's a symbol of many lives sacrificed, sacrificed to death, sacrificed on the picket lines, sacrificed in the political careers for standing up for the working class. So it's a pretty special day. But today, in our culture, it seems to me that what Labor Day symbolizes is clearly under attack. And sometimes we sit back passively when things are under attack, but I don't think we can do that, because if we do, we'll simply lose the gains that we have made as a progressive people. I thought about centering on this article, He's Back, concerning Karl Marx, but I thought that might have been a bit much to do that. So I'll just read one quote from that article to help us get started. Whether one adopts a moralistic or an analytical approach, there is scant doubt that capitalism continues to outmaneuver all attempts by wage earners to shift the odds in favor of shorter hours and more pay. In the story of the class struggle, it is invariably a case of one step forward and two steps back. I'm also reluctant, but not reluctant enough that I'm not going to do it, but reluctant to invoke Glenn Beck's name. I mean, as human beings, I think for the most part, we just like to live. Enjoy ourselves, enjoy our families, go to the beach, enjoy the weather, hide from the heat in Florida until it gets cool in the evening, or go out in the mornings. And that's about basically who we are as beings. We want to enjoy where we are, who we are, and what we're with. But then there comes a time when people interfere with other people's lives. People are willing to use other people for their own benefit. And people are willing to make plans and figure out schemes in order to do that. When that happens, there are other people who are called to stand up and address that intrusiveness. Because if we don't, we become passive in who we are and conform to that intrusiveness to being used by others. And I think that when we look at a movement that is being symbolized right now by Glenn Beck, and it is a movement being symbolized by him, he is a symbol, he isn't the whole thing. And we need to pay attention of what he symbolizes, because it has been with us for thousands of years, that which he symbolizes. I remember listening to him when he said he could smack his grandfather in his face because his grandfather supported Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Now, I didn't want to call in and say, well, you know, according to the Old Testament, if you smack your parent in the face, you get put to death. So claiming to be a biblical man, that he doesn't really adhere to biblical principles. But in thinking about that, well, first of all, let us keep in our mind that part of the agenda of what he symbolizes is the dismantling of whatever Franklin Delano Roosevelt put together. That's in there, in the mix. Doesn't always come to the surface, but it certainly is in the mix. So I invented a term and some thoughts to help guide our discussion, and I would encourage you to risk of revealing my grandiosity. encourage you to spread these around the world to help our cause in your emails and in your comments on the internet to different articles you might read. And the first one is NBC, Non-Biblical Christians. That we do seem to have this phenomena in our culture of people who are claiming Christianity, and we'll get to some of the biblical text in a minute to I think, support what I'm saying, and we can argue about it if you don't think so. We do seem today to have a group of people who claim that they are Christians, but yet the content of the biblical text is not congruent with who they claim they are. And I think enough is enough. Enough of that. We need to label that. And often when you label something, it gives us a way to address it, to confront it. So let's label it, non-biblical Christians. I'd also like to point out, see, it's Glenn Beck, he's inspiring to me. Just gets me going. I'd also like to point out that if you are biblically conservative, you will be socially liberal. You can't help it. When you read the scripture, and we'll read a bit in a minute, when you read it, and if you're going to be follow that model, there's no question you will be socially liberal. If you are socially conservative, you are biblically liberal. So these people are liberals that are claiming conservative. And some people will say that the Christian right has stolen Christianity and has stolen the Bible. And I'm here to say that what the Christian right has done is they have made the Bible irrelevant, is what they have done. It is no longer relevant in our society. We say that we are a Christian nation, but when we read the principles in Scripture that poverty is increasing. I was listening to this fellow talk the other day, and he said, if the gospel is not good news to the poor, it's not the gospel. And when I look at statistics, economic statistics in the past 30, 40, 50 years, there's not a lot of good news for the poor. It's just not there. To set us a bit in context of the world that we live in today, in reference to this movement that Glenn Beck, or maybe the method that this group of people that Glenn Beck symbolizes, the method they're using to accomplish their task, to put it in a bit of a context, right here in Gainesville, Florida, on the 11th of this month, there's a group of people who are proudly and righteously going to burn the Quran. I guess a number of Qurans to burn. Now, this has set, as you can imagine, a lot of different things in motion, and there's 1,000 people and Muslims in Indonesia who are protesting this. We also have that there's a Muslim cleric who's calling for the beheading of a world leader in the Netherlands, party leader in it. How in the world, if you say you're a person of peace, do you fan this fire? How in the world do you do that? I was listening again, things I'll do for a sermon, listening again to Glenn Beck's show last night, I guess to aggravate myself and look for information. And he had this rabbi on, a Unitarian Universalist, and in our house, you know, we join together out of principles, the 7 principles we read. The heart of our value system, as I understand it, moves us to be kinder to ourselves and to others. I think that's the heart of our message. And in our house, we can have Christian, we can have Muslim, we can have atheist, we can have agnostic, we can have Baha'i. That's not our deal to find out what label you wear and decide whether you're acceptable or not on that label. Our concern is, are we growing to be kinder toward one another and toward ourselves? I was listening to a rabbi speak. Now, I don't know, Glenn Beck's got... Just think about what our country's come to in mass media. He has a religious show now on a news channel and guests around, and this rabbi's talking about atheists. And he says that atheists are parasites that thrive on the faithful who have made this great nation. And I think, what? It doesn't even make sense. It doesn't make sense, but it is being used against us. So how do we, as Unitarian Universalists, as human beings that try to move toward kindness, to human beings that try to have the courage for the search for truth and meaning as clearly as we can, how do we move out from, say, our comfortable lives, our enjoying creation, our enjoying a kayaking, our enjoying one another, or enjoying the football, but trying to live our lives? I think we are called to respond. When societies have signs of oppression and signs of manipulation away from the care of the general population, and the people have not responded to that, it has not turned out well. So in a way, in responding to that, we are called out of what our normal lives would be, and we are called into some kind of action. And so to help us get some conversation, some language, and some thoughts in our head to this movement that's using religious propaganda as its base, we're reclaiming God for America, that kind of language, I thought it might be helpful to look at the story of Moses, and who's relevant for three Abrahamic faiths, for Jewish, for Christian, for Muslims, and to get a handle, maybe some language and how to respond to these folks when we're talking to these people. And certainly the first is, I can't imagine myself in a coffee shop saying to somebody, you know, I figured out who you are. You're a non-biblical Christian. But I'm starting to see it. But then I've got to support it. And then I've got to back it up. So how am I going to back it up? Well, first of all, on this Labor Day, I am going to clearly say that the Bible, the Christian sacred text, is a labor document. It is also a document for civil liberties. So now I'm going to defend that a little bit. Okay. In the book of Exodus, and you know, Exodus is a story that is about the delivery of a group of people who have been enslaved to do the work of others, and because others feared them. But at first, when this group of people went into the land of Egypt, Joseph, one of the heroes in Hebrew tradition, really saved people in Egypt from famine. He figured out a system, a way to store up food and to house food and so that it could feed a people. It was very bright in the way he administrated that process. So he and his other Hebrews, they were held in high esteem. But several hundred years passed, and this Pharaoh comes to this conclusion. And these are the names of the son of Israel who went to Egypt: Jacob, each with his family, Reuben, Simon, Levi, Judah, the 12 brothers. And Joseph and all his brothers had died, and now some generations had passed. Then a new king, who did not know about Joseph, came to power in Egypt. And he said, "Look at these people, the Israelites. They have become too numerous for us. Come, we must deal with them shrewdly. We must deal with them shrewdly, or they will become even more numerous. If war breaks out, they will join our enemies and fight against us and leave the country." Now, he has no evidence of this. It's a fear of what could happen. Period. That's all it says. And why is he afraid they'll leave the country? Because they're the laborers of the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor, with brick and mortar, with all kinds of work in the fields. and the hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. So I was walking around in my yard the other day and stumbled, and I found these glasses. They were magic glasses. And when I looked through these magic glasses at the Bible, the dates changed. And it brought them right up to date. And this is what I found through these glasses. And these are the names of the sons and daughters of labor who immigrated to the United States of America looking for a man of silk and honey. Eugene Debb, Samuel Gompers, Mother Jones, Pauline Newman, Albert Shanker, and others. These and their descendants were in great number. Now, Eugene Debs and Mother Jones and all their brothers and sisters had died generations earlier, but the middle class was fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so that the land was filled with the middle class people who considered themselves important enough to join the decision-making process of the laws of their land. Then a new president, who did not know Eugene Debs or the working class Civil War in the early 20th century, came to power. "Look," he said to his people, "they think they can go on strike anytime. Fire all the air traffic controllers. The working and middle class have become too numerous for us. Come, we must deal with them shrewdly, or they will become too numerous and decide the laws of our land, and we will become like them, owners of only one or two houses." So they moved the factories to the land where there was no middle class, no worker rights, and put slave masters over them and oppressed them with forced labor. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so the transnational capitalist class — I thought that was good for their special glasses to come up with that one. So the transnational capitalist class came to dread and fear the middle class and those who fight for worker rights. So they worked them ruthlessly and kept them in factories and built high fences so no one could get in or out. They robbed them of their land, of their health care, of their civil liberties, and granted non-living wealthy entities the rights of persons. They made their lives bitter with hard labor and brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. And in all their hard labor, the ruling class used them ruthlessly. Then they decided to stop educating the poor to create a pathway directly to privatized prisons. But the middle class women created small schools and Unitarian Universalist churches to educate the poor so that they might know the truth and grow to be wise and challenge the enslaving master race. I hate to think if I read the whole book with those glasses, what that might look like. But it fits. It's the same thing. The story of Moses is a story of labor. Why did the God of Moses move to free the people? The God of Moses moved to free the people because the God of Moses heard their cry. And why were they crying? They were crying because they were living in oppressive labor systems, is why they were crying. The whole Moses story is about deliverance from poor labor conditions. The three faith traditions, the Muslims, the Jewish, and then the Christians, find that one of their main prophets was a prophet about labor conditions. If that's so, what might we see in the Ten Commandments that was given to Moses? In the Ten Commandments, you have things do not have. It begins with this. It begins with, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." So the whole foundation for the Ten Commandments is based in deliverance from slavery. That's what it's based in. It's a document to protect people from being enslaved. And it, you know, it begins. Do not put it, you will have no other gods before me. You shall make yourself no idols. When it says that, I never really understood that before, because I always thought, okay, no other gods before me, and there's this God up here. But this God also represents, and I'm not to have anything between myself and the understanding of that God represents fair labor conditions. That's what that God represents, because that's what God delivered them from. So we move down, and I never fully understood, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. For 6 days you shall labor, and you shall not work. You shall not work, your son shall not work, your daughter shall not work, your male or female slave, there will be no work. Well, here's a society that says to laborers, to the working class, hey, you get a day off. You don't have to work 7 days a week. As a matter of fact, it's against the law, the Ten Commandments, the law, for you to work 7 days a week. For 6 days, then they create, or as the myth says, this is exactly what God did, for 6 days labored. And then you have, you shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal. These are also rules that go to the king. The Ten Commandments are boundaries for everybody in that society, including the king. You shall not steal. You shall not commit murder. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or male or female slave, or ox or donkey. And I'm thinking, wasn't it AGI that ordained 400 people to figure out plans to make money with derivatives that ended up with millions of people losing their houses? The resources over here were coveted by this group of people, and they figured out a way how to steal these resources and give them to themselves regardless of the misery of others. How much different is that than in the 1100s and the 1200s when the church at that particular point said, we want this land, and so you shall not falsely accuse. Women were falsely accused of being witches. They were burnt and their property stolen. Is it much different? Afghanistan right now, we've discovered, I suspect we've known for quite some time, $1 trillion worth of minerals. You shall not covet your neighbor's goods, your neighbor's resources. You shall not murder to achieve and acquire those goods and those resources. You shall not commit crimes. You shall not be full of corruption to get the resources. The Bible has been made irrelevant in our society. These rules, they do no longer contain our imagination so that we treat one another well or not. So how do we respond as Unitarian Universalists? I was also looking through the internet's a great thing, isn't it, when you're doing research. I'm afraid it might feed my attention deficit disorder because you just go right, it's hard to. So I've started a new habit while I'm exercising. I'm trying to memorize poems just to kind of crack that surface thing. But in my search, I found this article about heroes of the labor movement. And what I thought I'd do is just read a bit about each of those heroes. And as I read through them, for you to try to say, what's the value system that person's coming from? And compare them to Unitarian Universalist values. And these are clearly heroes from the labor movement. And when we look at the principles and values of delivering people from slavery in the story of Moses, and when we look at and try to understand the Ten Commandments and that, and we look at our seven principles, kind of locate who we are as a group of people, kind of put that together, and as I read through these, just kind of grasp where the value, what value system these people are coming from. Cesar Chavez, United Farm Workers. It's ironic that those who till the soil, cultivate and harvest the fruits, vegetables, and other foods that fill your tables with abundance have nothing left for themselves. A girl, textile worker, when asked how old she was, she hesitated and she said, "I don't remember." Now, when you ask an 8, 9, 10, 11-year-old child how old they are, they know, because they're 8 and 3 quarters. They're on their way to 9. They're 11 and a half. They're 10, but they're going to be 11 next week, so they're 11. They tell you how old they are, but not this little girl. But she said confidently, "I'm not old enough to work, but do just the same." Out of 50 employees, they were 10 children. Eugene Debs, "While there is a lower class, I am in it. While there is a criminal element, I am of it. While there is a soul in prison, I am not free." Debs fought tirelessly for radical workers' rights, workmen's compensation, pension, Social Security, radical rights, stuff that now is, we think, normal, but it certainly seems to be being attacked. Now, I don't know if you know, Eugene Debs ran for president for the Socialist Party 5 times. The last time he ran for president, he ran from a prison cell. Almost got 1 million votes. He was in prison because he protested our participation in World War I. Threw him in prison for that. Samuel Gompers, "To be free, the workers must have a choice. To have a choice, they must retain in their own hands, the right to determine under what conditions they will work." Think about the miners, West Virginia, Pennsylvania. Do they get to determine? Mother Jones, Mary Harris, she says, "Pray for the dead, but fight like hell for the living." Gotta love her. She organized a march with child mill workers from Pennsylvania to New York to President Theodore Roosevelt's house. That'd be a long walk, wouldn't it? We'd have to pick the season to do that. And I never fully understood why the teachers' union has been so demonized. I mean, you know the news, the teachers' union this and teachers' union that, and to demonize. Well, now I understand it. The National Education Association, which merged with the teachers' union three or four decades ago, here's what they have done since 1857. Okay. In 1912, they endorsed the women's suffrage movement. They, 1919, they fought for the first state pension. 1945, every state had a pension. 1941, they lobbied Congress for special public schools near military bases. 45, the GI Bill of Rights. 58, the National Defense Educational Act. 64, the Civil Rights Act. 68, the Bilingual Educational Act. They appealed to the Supreme Court to make it unlawful to fire pregnant teachers or forced maternity leaves. They fought for passage of the Federal Retirement Equality Law that provides the means to end sexual discrimination against women in retirement funds. We would never have known there was discrimination in retirement funds, would we have? Lobbied for changes for No Child Left Behind. No wonder they're demonized. They're fighting for the working class. They're a national organization, international organization of 3 million members with a budget of $259 million a year fighting for the working class. Francis Perkin, U.S. Secretary of Labor under Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I came to Washington to work for, here's a twist, I came to Washington to work for God, FDR, and the millions of forgotten, plain, common working men. Philip Randolph, Brotherhood of the Sleeping Car Porters, Railroad Union. Freedom is never granted. It is won. Justice is never given. It is exacted. Freedom and justice must be struggled for by the oppressed of all the lands and races. And on it goes. There is a movement in our society that is saying that these rights and the rights of working people are, what's the word they use? Entitlements that must be removed because it's costing our nation too much. It's too much of a burden on our nation. Now candidates are flat out saying that we must get rid of Social Security for our nation to survive. How many people do you know that depend on Social Security for their well-being? 20 more million people would immediately move into poverty if Social Security were removed. There is a movement in our country that's intrusive, that's encroaching on the well-being of the population in our nation. As Moses was called to respond and go in and speak to Pharaoh, can you imagine you being called to go speak to President Obama? He was scared and hesitant, but went through a few things to get him there. Who will be called today to respond to this intrusion of oppression on the working people and the non-wealthy class people? Forgetting our theology, the Unitarian Universalists have always been in the thick of standing up. And one last thing about Mr. Beck that irked me when he claimed to be part of the civil rights movement, that one of our heroes in the Unitarian Universalist world, James Reed, went down to Selma, and several Unitarian Universalist ministers went down there to march with him, was murdered. So here's a man, to me, doing just the opposite of what he's saying, claiming the right to stand next to people who have really sacrificed in our nation and is moving our country in a direction that's directly opposed to our values. We are being called to stand up and to speak today.